Wow.
Okay, we're going to watch the hockey game together. What are you laughing at? That's exactly what we're doing. We're watching the hockey game together. I think it's in a commercial. I was watching it delayed a little while ago. And now we'll... Oh, there we go. Normally the news. No, that's not what I want to do. Let's see. Any of you watch the game? I'm just going to sit here in the hopes that somebody's listening. I doubt they are, because probably three-quarters of the people interested in sports, if not 90% of them, or more, are watching the Leaf game. Why would they be doing that? Well, because it's our national sport. So there it is in the background. And what I've seen through this whole series... Aaron's too busy. He's nervous drinking. We've watched a series where the rules have changed drastically in a matter of moments, where different definitions of interference have been displayed, where little interference is a penalty, absolute interference is not. It's been the kind of series, this Boston-Toronto series, has clearly shown, in my opinion, a favoritism towards the Boston Bruins because they have not been accountable for some violent acts. First of all, the headshot was not reviewed, as far as I know, to Lupo. At the very least, if it's not a penalty, it should be reviewed. Tonight, JVR was elbow to the nose, bloodied, with an elbow to the head. Let's see if that gets reviewed. You know, where the point of contact is the head. That is the major question. So at the end of the day, it's been an interesting playoff. I admire what the Toronto Maple Leafs have done. I'm not a Leaf fan. I'm a Toronto fan. I'm a Toronto boy, and we've talked about that before. I think Toronto's a beautiful city, a great city, a city that deserves pride. What I will say, though, is as far as the CBC is concerned, they're shameful in their coverage of this series. They make excuses for the bad calls by the league. If you notice, there was no mention of the elbow to JVR. At any time did the CBC even mention it? Well, obviously, they are fearful of what might happen if they become the fifth estate when it comes to hockey. There's no other explanation. And if anybody thinks that I'm crazy, just look at the facts. Shots to the head are reviewable. And if there's no mention of why it's not a punishment attached, then what kind of accountability are you creating in the players? Well, you might be with other players, but you won't be with the Boston Bruins. Now, coincidentally or not, the question is the fact that the president of the league, the guy, the big poobah of the league, is the Boston Bruins owner. Does he garner any favoritism because of his position? Well, societal speaking, in fact, it's quite true. It's very possible. You know, conflict of interest is something that enters into society in many different ways. And I'm claiming that in here, in this situation, there's favoritism being shown to Boston, and I believe there's a crime being committed, and follow the money. And the money is this: the lack of penalizing the Boston Bruins for bloodying opponents to the head without any accountability or assertion of innocence or guilt. That's the question that I raise. So now that may sound like a Toronto Maple Leaf fan to you, and I'll accept that. I'll accept that being interpreted that way. All I ask is that you look at the facts. Shots to the head should be reviewed. Were they reviewed? No, they were not. A guy's elbowed in the middle of the ice in the head, bloodied, and no penalty. And let me say this as well. You and I all know, anybody who's watched hockey any amount of time knows that a call sometimes ends up being called because the two refs didn't see it, but somebody else saw it. That didn't happen in this situation. And a bloodied nose, drawing blood, is an important issue in hockey. If you high stick somebody, it's a major. So, at the end of the day, this is what I'm saying. And does it really matter? Well, you know, the people who allow themselves to be manipulated by the powers that be at the CBC should be ashamed of themselves for not insuring. In fact, I even wrote a letter to the CBC complaining about the players laughing about the, sorry, I'm sorry, the on-air people laughing about a cross-check to the neck in one of the American games. They thought it was funny. But I was told, well, you know, it's not our job to, that we'll give that to the sports department, and they, in turn, will make a decision based on what they understand to be the truth. The fact remains, nothing happened of it. And the CBC is basically playing the typical corporate game where they're playing the typical corporate game where basically they're protecting the guilty. And that's good. So the Boston Bruins win. Now, unfortunately, in my opinion, I think it is a tainted victory. We will see if there's any suspensions or any punishments for the elbows to the head. And they've done a masterful job of basically taking a game away.
I'm just a regular Joe with a regular job. I'm your average white Leaside like snob. I like porno and Proline and books about porn. I got an average house with nice hardwood floors. My wife, my job, my kids and my car. My feet on my table and a Cuban cigar. But sometimes that just ain't enough to keep a man like me interested.
Oh, no.
No way.
Uh-huh.
Now I gotta wear double blue and hit the subway downtown.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, 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 yeah. I need football big on a really big field. No silicone cheerleaders. I want my chicks real. I'm an Argo. I fly to BC and hide all their weed. I go to Regina and say, how about that wheat? I'm an Argo. I'm an Argo. I pocket Commonwealth and take Edmonton spaces while Edmonton people make Edmonton faces. I'm an Argo. I'm an Argo.
Maybe I shouldn't be singing this song, writing, raving, and carrying on. Maybe they're right when they say that I'm wrong.
Nah. I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
I'm an Argo.
Such a
big
Argo.
You know what I'm going to do? I'm going to get myself one of those Condridge Holloway Mets jerseys circa 1982 with the midriff showing, just like those skanky Queen Street Lady Gaga wannabes, and walk right into Harbor 60, and there's nothing nobody can do about it. Yeah! And I'm going to talk about the Argos on the radio anytime I want, because unlike that 60-year-old from The Fan who wears sunglasses on TV, I actually go to the games. Okay! They can take their 20 years of boring people with their Dungeons & Dragons staff and have a great big 20-year-old cakewalk right in the middle of Yonge Street, and it will make a lick of difference. You know why? Because we got the bombs. Yeah! We got Schultz, Dennegan, frickin' Naylor, and frickin' Randorf. I'll tell you what I'm gonna do. I'm gonna get Bill Simons, Joe Kroll, Terry Greer, and frickin' Don Moen, and a giant case of Crown Royal, and we're gonna go right down.
Hey, you know what, pal? You really are an Argo.
just shut up and sing the song, pal.
I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
I'm an Argo.
He's an Argo.
Yo, 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 yo.
Hey, Argo. Oh, 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 oh. I'm over there.
I'm an Argo, and I'm proud of it.
Well, there you go. Where's John? I should call him. Maybe he'll answer. Okay. So, the Leafs lose. That means it's Boston against New York, which is a great series for the American market. It's a wonderful situation for them. And really, a congratulations to the sincere Boston fans, the people of Boston for sure. The fans that are Bruins fans, not so sure so much. They're kind of... Oh, really? Nobody likes a sore loser. But to suggest that there wasn't any... anyway, enough about that. I'm having fun here on Facebook. How about you? Well, now Leaf fans have to take this abuse. See, this is why it bothers me so much when the fix is in, and it's obvious the fix is in. Now the poor Leaf fans, why I'm not one, because I don't like myself being an easy target. And being a Leaf fan is an easy target. You're loyal to your team, and your team gets no respect. Your guys are beaten mercilessly with impunity. The Boston Bruins were allowed to bloody many a Maple Leaf. This goes back to the way it was with the Flyers. It's all the same story, just a rehashing of what took place many years ago. The Broad Street Bullies, the Boston Bullies, they could not win. They could not win this series without the help of the officials and them turning a blind eye to some of the acts that the Bruins took. Anyway, enough about that. The rest of the series are going to be really interesting. And I got to tell you, I'm really going to enjoy the New York-Boston series because now I'm dying to see how the officials are going to deal with this one. And anybody who thinks that hockey is just a sport is a fool. It's a business. And it operates based on what's good for business as far as the boardroom is concerned. So that means that what's good for the people who are in the boardroom is what matters. And as I said before, conflict of interest notwithstanding, it exists in business, in life. And it's just too bad. Leaf fans, your guys did a great job. They played a great game. They played a great game and they tried to overcome the handicap of playing the team that was favored by the officiating and by the league. They did a great job. I'm proud of the job they did. And to refer to that as being a choke, that they choked, that's just not true. And, eventually you give a team all the breaks in officiating and you ignore the penalties they deserve. Eventually they're going to get a good break and something good's going to happen for them because that's the way sport is. Now, this, I guess I got to turn off the TV now. I can watch that stuff later. It was a great game. It was great hockey. You know, you had your tough, unpenalized play in the game. It was awesome. Yeah, I guess I do sound like a sore loser, but you know what? That's mainly due to the fact that, like the people in Boston who Boston fans are referring to the fact that they're Boston strong. In other words, this bad thing that happened to them, they can overcome anything. Here's the thing. They bring it into the conversation as if to suggest that the two have to have something to do with each other. In other words, what happened at the marathon is why Boston is what Boston is, or why the Bruins should win. When in fact, what happened to Boston is no different, not in the same manner, that what happened to the Leafs. They were abused, and we'll just see if there's any justice coming from the league on the incidents that took place, the headshots, head trauma that took place. We'll see if there's any justice coming from the league. Like we hoped and wished, the justice came for those animals that blew up innocent people, killing innocent people, maiming innocent people. It's all about justice, and hopefully there'll be some justice that an elbow to the head of JBR that was intended for his head will be penalized. Not like what happened when Lucic elbowed Lupul in the head in the corner with an elbow. Again, I repeat, justice is justice for all. You know, justice for some is not justice for all, and is not justice. So that's all I'm saying. Anyway, so let's move over to another sport, one that I enjoy talking about. We'll take a short break, and then we'll come back. And this is disappointing. Being a Toronto boy, I had a chance to celebrate something, and the Leafs had victory snatched, or defeat snatched from the arms of victory. Way to go, Riders. Here's my feeling on how the Bruins won the game. It was so pretty.
I feel pretty, oh so pretty. I feel pretty and witty and gay. And I pity any girl who's in me today. I feel charming, so charming, it's alarming how charming I feel, and so pretty, and I hardly can believe I'm real. See the pretty girl in that mirror there, who can that attractive girl be? Such a pretty face, such a pretty dress, such a pretty smile, such a pretty me. I feel stunning, and then prancing, feel like running and dancing for joy. For I'm loved by your pretty, wonderful boy.
You know what? I like that part so much. Let's go with the second part.
Have you met my good friend Maria, the craziest girl on the block? You know her the minute you see her. She's the one who is in an advanced state of shock. She thinks she's in love. She thinks she's insane. She isn't in love. She's merely insane. It must be the heat or some rare disease.
La la la.
Or too much to eat.
Or maybe it's sleep.
Keep away from her before she knows. This is not the Marie Louise. So modest and pure, all like every mind. Well bred and mature, and out of her mind.
Miss America, bravo, speech!
I feel pretty, oh, so pretty, that the city should give me its key. Oh, committee should be honored to honor me.
La 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 la.
I feel dizzy, I feel funny, I feel dizzy and funny and fine and so pretty. Miss America can just resign.
La 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 la.
Is a pretty girl in much mirror?
What mirror? Where?
Who can such a tremble be?
Which? What?
Where? Who? Such a pretty face, such a pretty dress, such a pretty smile, such a pretty me. I feel stunning, and then prancing,
and prancing,
like running,
like running, and
joy,
for a love, for your pretty, wonderful boy.
You know, it's amazing how people think that winning is winning. There are a few people in the world and in society in general that believe that winning isn't just about winning. Sometimes it matters how you win. Maybe that's why I dislike the way this went and why it bothers me so much that I see a clear favoritism by the officials. And the favoritism is there for you to see. Anyone who recorded the game, watch the game again. Ask yourself, what is an interference penalty? And then apply it to the game. Even apply it, like, you know, when I play cards with people, I say, you know, people who cheat, as long as they only cheat once. In other words, once they establish what the rules are, I don't like them cheating twice. I get really pissed at people who cheat twice. And tonight we saw that the league, through the officials, cheated more than once tonight. You know, the odd thing is one thing, but the ongoing onslaught of poor officiating, which directly had a, well, it directly cost the Leafs the game. Whether you see it that way or not, doesn't matter to me, because this is my opinion. My opinion is based on watching the game. Ask yourself this question, just a couple of questions. An elbow to the head, is it a penalty or not? A. B. What is the definition in your mind? I'm asking you in your own mind, all of you, Bruins fans, Leaf fans, neutral fans, what is an interference penalty? Well, here, I'm going to give you my opinion of an interference penalty. An interference penalty to me is hitting a guy before he has a chance to play the puck or long after he plays the puck. That's my definition of interference. It's really that simple. Then I want you to watch the game in that regard and then tell me how many missed calls there were on each side of the equation. See if you can look at it without bias, with neutrality in mind, and we'll go from there. You know, why are we as people against things like, because in discussing the officiating, it came down to, you know, Boston strong. We're Boston strong. So, you know, the Bruins fans bring in the marathon. And then you say to them, you say, well, you know, just because you experience that doesn't mean you get favoritism. And then they say, how dare you spit on us being Boston strong? Do you see what I'm saying? The real question is, do you care what I'm saying? Probably not. But if you do, thank you. So that's all I'm going to say. As far as sports is concerned, people suggest that sports are pure. They're not pure. most of them are fixed. And all you can hope for is that as a fan, they might get fixed in your direction. We've seen it in Italian soccer. We've seen it in other sports as well. We've seen it in football. We've seen fixes in there. We've seen Lance Armstrong. We all know the story about Lance Armstrong. So, in essence, in my opinion, sports are crooked. You know, and so therefore, can we really celebrate a victory knowing that it's quite likely that that victory is tarnished? So, to me, what's left is it's not a question of whether sports are tarnished. It's a question of how tarnished they are. And how can a sport be that way and get to the, let's say just for the sake of discussion, that maybe I'm right and the officiating was kind of trashy. How can they get away with that? Well, it's very simple. If the media decides not to make an issue of it, for example, an elbow to the head in the corner and not ask to review it or not ask why it wasn't reviewed or not ask why it wasn't a penalty. Because as soon as the league, the NHL, is made accountable for every act that's made on the ice, they are setting the groundwork for basically equity within the league. As soon as they don't answer when one team does something and only answer when other teams do, equity becomes an issue. Let's take, for example, tonight, the littering of the ice. The Coyotes did that last year and got a penalty. The Coyote fans, they got a penalty, but it wasn't a penalty tonight. Why was it a penalty then and why wasn't it tonight? We refer to many a time, for those of us that talk about sports and the supposed experts, they use the term inconsistency. Why is it inconsistent? Joffrey Lupul earlier this year asked, what's a penalty and what isn't a penalty? How am I supposed to know what's a penalty and what? I'm confused. Well, the reason he's confused is because he gets hit, no penalty. He hits somebody the same way, it's a penalty. So that would cause someone to be confused. See, when something like that happens, in my mind, I don't know about you folks, I ask myself, why? Why is it a penalty at once and not a penalty the other time? So all one can do is try to correlate or find out, you know, who has to gain. You know, let's just see who gains from this not happening. In other words, not being a call not being investigated, a call not being a penalty. Why is it a penalty for one team, not for the other? That's the point I'm trying to make. And it's the same thing within society and justice in general. Justice is all about equity. Justice is all about, you know, we're all, as the American Constitution says, created equal. But like Animal Farm showed us, a book, a very old book, Animal Farm showed us there's the term more equal. I know that doesn't make sense, but it actually speaks to what I'm talking about. And tonight what I saw on the ice and what I saw this whole series, it was consistent throughout the series. There was more equality for the Bruins than there was for the Leafs. The Leafs eventually, let's face it, you can't skate uphill forever. If the officials and if the teams that's supposed to win isn't you, eventually you get tired and you run out of gas. And that's what happened with the Leafs tonight. And it's a shame. It's a shame because Boston won, and congratulations to them. But I do raise some issue with how they won. And again, I repeat, watch the game, define penalties, then watch the game. But write it down. Define the penalty and write it down, and then watch the game. And maybe I'm right. Maybe I am. Maybe the fix wasn't. Maybe the Bruins do have an edge that the Leafs didn't have. Maybe the Bruins had an advantage, you know. In a close series like this, the tiniest of advantage can turn a big victory by a team into a close loss. And that is what I'm contending today. Very disappointed in the CBC, especially the CBC, the cowardice of the CBC, to mention elbows to the head that happened. Mention if previous elbows within the series were reviewed. And this is the sad part. This is what makes our society poor. a lack of fairness is something that, you know, I totally believe in fairness. I totally believe in playing a card game by the rules right through. And if I don't want to lose, then I don't play. But if I don't want to lose and I want to play, and to make sure I don't lose, I ask for a little help. What kind of win is that? Shallow, to say the least. Anyway, John said he was going to call. I don't think he's in a happy mood to call because things didn't work out the way he hoped. And it really did look good for the Leafs tonight. It just didn't turn out that way. CFL, and let's start out in BC Lions territory. As it turns out, BC Lions have added 7 players through the draft. 2 of them were young Canadians, lineman Spencer Lang and Whitman Tomisiak. And they've received invitations to training camp. So the 3-day mini camp will include these 2 youngsters. And it'll go from May 30th to June 1st. And folks, less than 45 days before our first game. They play junior football in BC, so they drafted local boys. Good for the BC Lions. Toronto has tried really hard to do that, bring in local guys. We're very happy to play for their home team. And it's important that you have young players. Young players especially that are really good. And other good news, well, this doesn't work without the pitchers. The Felines in BC. It doesn't work without the pitchers. I could play it, but I can't play it. Without the pitchers, it's not the same. So Travis Lule, BC quarterback, the large-sized talent, is ready to carry his team after being knocked out on October 12th and not play the final regular season game. He's ready to get back in there. Now, obviously, they failed to advance to the 100th Grey Cup. They were a favorite going in. It didn't work out that way. Now you've got, there's some injuries also early in some of the minicamps. Thomas DeMarco and Jarrett Brown, they were hurt. They're fine now. So Lule feels great. Unfortunately, this doesn't sound good. When you don't know where the back injury came from, how do you treat what you don't know what exists? So hopefully Lule and GM Wally Bono will have a better season, and of course, they're a team that I really think could be really big this year. Really, really big. So we do know that Bono and company made some draft picks for the long term this year, and they're not in a big hurry for those young players to carry the team. It's important that those young players that they drafted work into the lineup. Now, we do know that you know, the ratio is a big thing. Canadians on the front line, that seems to be the standard ploy by all the teams. It's what they want to do. And on that note, you've got your Edmonton Eskimos have added more Canadian talent. Non-import defensive lineman Gregory Alexander, Ismael Bamba, and these guys are very important to the club because every time you throw a Canadian out there that can compete with the American players, not be better, but at least compete, that helps your overall ratio and that helps you bring in Americans who excel at their position and excel in the league. So, yeah, you know, Ismael Bamba is a great receiver. He's done really well. Now, originally, Alexander was drafted by the Toronto Argonauts in the 2011 Canadian draft. But now he is in Edmonton. As part, I think it was a part of a trade that they did. They traded some players. And so a couple of young players are going to help Edmonton truly become a bit more of a team. It's really nice this time of year for all of us, CFL fans. Our teams all have a great chance. Now, being an Argos season ticket holder, I know our team has a good chance. They won the Grey Cup last year. Does that mean this year is going to be that good? No, no guarantee. No guarantee at all. Also, the Esks also signed import Rico Wallace and import running back John White. Wallace finished his collegiate career as the Shenandoah Hornets' all-time leader with 189 receptions. And he scored 28 touchdowns. And he was named the second team All-Star in Division III, All-American. Now, he did sign with the Carolina Panthers as an undrafted free agent. On the other hand, White set school records for rushing yards per game and career 100-yard games. He had 14. He ranked sixth in school history in career rushing yards with 2,560. Fourth all-time in career rushes. So these are two players that Edmonton will indeed be relying on. This is a team that that has a lot of hope in the future, and that hope will be with their youth. Now, I guess I should remind all you folks that you can pick up tickets to all the CFL teams through the internet. If you go to CFL.com, you can buy tickets and you'll get all the links that take you to your team. Hey, even if you're an out-of-towner and you're planning on coming to Toronto and you live in a non-CFL town, well, heck, even if you live in a CFL town and you want to check out a CFL game, you're not going to get a better bargain for the price. The games are awesome. Keep in mind, I speak quite frankly because I didn't have season tickets until this year. Now you got Glenn last year, and we're into Calgary now. Okay, now Kevin Glenn played in the Grey Cup. Didn't have a really good game at the 100th Grey Cup, the game that they lost 35-22 to the Argos, the 100th Grey Cup at the Rogers Centre. And there's some talk that understudy Drew Tate could very well take the team out of the gate. But then again, Kevin Glenn, I don't think he was to blame for what happened. I think Calgary as a team came out flat in that game. And being who they are and the makeup of the team, I don't doubt that there's an opportunity and a belief in their hearts that they could actually go all the way. But I truly believe in the past few years, I've really hooked on to the CFL in the past couple of years. Really, I've bitten down hard on the CFL. And in the times that I was watching a little further away, it seemed to me like, I don't know, it just seemed like there wasn't that much competition. You pretty much knew who was going to end up there at the end of the year. I think this year is going to be one of the most heated, competitive seasons the CFL has had to offer in years. And don't believe me. Just watch what happens. There's a lot of news out there that bodes well for a lot of teams, and giving them a lot of hope And that hope is far-reaching, to say the least. Now, Stampeders, that's about it for the Stampeders. I think we could move on. Let's keep moving east. And in moving east, we end up, of course, to the franchise that's hosting the 101st Grey Cup. The franchise, in my mind, that is the favorite to win the Grey Cup. Now, I have some Argo friends who will disagree with me, but I happen to think that the Rider Nation is making a very serious bid to win the 101st Grey Cup. Now, to say the least, as their webpage indicates, the Saskatchewan Rough Riders have had a very successful off-season. Anyone who doesn't want to admit that, well, you got a lot to learn, because it's been a very, very, as they put it on their webpage, a very successful off-season. Brendan Taman was signed for, I think, another 2 years. And he has moved, and he has brought in players. My favorite Argo, and Tristan Black, they brought him in. They brought in the best Canadian at the Grey Cup, Ricky Foley. You know, they've done a lot of things to make their team much better. G. Roy Simon. Could you imagine having G. Roy Simon as basically your second or third receiver? How's that for an option for the quarterback? Huh. Yeah, well, thankfully, Mitchell Blair wrote an article on their webpage, and he was referring to what I'm saying, is how incredibly wonderful this team, this Saskatchewan team, this Rough Rider team, they're building an instant winner. And what does the Saskatchewan reporter write? He writes that, well, look at the Blue Jays, the Toronto Blue Jays. They were supposed to win it all. What happened to them? Mitchell makes a great point. Buddy, you're 100% right. I mean, you know, it is what it is. And that is that all that the management can do, and it's a lot that they can do. Let's remember this. Now, let's keep this in mind, because this is what has to be understood in as far as the Blue Jays, since Mitchell has taken the comparison of the Blue Jays. The Blue Jays do not, in no way do the Blue Jays compare to the Saskatchewan Rough Riders. And here's why I'm going to say it. The Blue Jays did not have an established manager this year, or head coach to correlate and to make the discussion clearer for those of us. And it's really what it is, and let's be honest. Blue Jay fans, you were banking on a new manager, a bunch of new players joining a team that couldn't win more than they lost. Or did they? Maybe they won two games more than they lost last year. The point is, though, Saskatchewan starting with making the playoffs, being a really good football team, a contender. I don't think anybody would have been surprised if Saskatchewan had made it to the Grey Cup. I know I wouldn't have been. The fact that the Argos beat them in Saskatchewan at the end of the season was a real builder of confidence for the Argos, because they beat a great team. The GM is the same GM, and the coach is the same coach. And then what they've done is they brought better assistant coaches in. They brought in better players, adding to the great players that they had to begin with. So it's a very intelligent thing that the management, or this beat writer, the point that he makes, is that he's basically given Saskatchewan a heads up, something the Toronto Blue Jays didn't get, least of all from management. Opening day, they built him up to be this undefeatable champion, this runaway train that was going to win 162 games and lose none. On the other hand here, well-armed, forewarned is forearmed. So, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the Saskatchewan Rough Riders don't have to worry about this going to their head. I don't think so, because I happen to think that they're quite aware that just because you make moves that mathematically look right doesn't mean you're going to win. Just so you know, Argos, I'm drinking out of my gray cup. Wait, I'll save that for the, I'll save that for when we get to the Argos. So yeah, the Argos, we had a town hall, but let's continue with Saskatchewan. So they made a lot of moves this year, and Saskatchewan looks to be really one of the favorites coming out of the gate. I truly believe they'll be one of the favorites coming out of the gate, and I don't think anybody can suggest that they're going to let it go to their heads. And I think this team's ready to win, which is really what's important, is being ready to win. It's one thing to want to win, but you got to be ready to win. And this is what happened to the Maple Leafs tonight. They were not ready to win. Now, having said all I said about real ugly apparent favoritism, what I will say is this, is it was a learning lesson for the team. And they had their foot on their throat and they let go. They did a great job of ignoring the officiating throughout. Unfortunately, they didn't ignore it at the end. They were afraid to even touch a Bruin because they knew they were going to get a penalty, because that's just the way it was. And that's what causes the problems, in my opinion. So moving on to the Winnipeg Blue Bombers. What is this? They got a new mascot? What's going on here? Oh, it's just Buzz and Boomer. So any Winnipeg fans out there, explain to me who Buzz and Boomer are. They look like toys. Muppets. Yeah, they do. They look like Muppets. They look like birds with football helmets and giant goggles. That makes them interesting, don't you think? Don't you know that makes them interesting? Now, Winnipeg, you know, I mean, when the lead story on your webpage is about your mascots, one has to be worried about what the team's trying to establish out there. Oh, well, what the heck. Why don't we just leave it at that? So the Winnipeg Blue Bombers also announced that the junior football player, Brett Carter, the young guy, is going to participate in training camp next month. Carter has played the last two seasons with the Winnipeg Rifles of the Canadian Junior Football League. After he suited up for the St. Utah Mustangs, Carter joined the Rifles last year, and he started six games in his first year. Now, he led the conference in receptions and yards, and he was named the CJFL All-Canadian and took home MVP honors with the Rifles. And he is a top Prairie Football Conference All-Star. Now, that seems to be the trend in the CFL, and I think that's a good trend, is that they are really looking for local players to make a splash and make their team very local. And that local feeling, I think, is really important. I know that here in Toronto, it was a big deal. Jim Barker wanted to make sure that he brought in a lot of Toronto guys. And he's still doing it. He's still bringing in Toronto guys. So I'm sorry I keep going back to the Argos, but they are my experience. And for those of you that are Winnipeg fans, you know, kudos to your management team for bringing in local guys, because I think that's really important. And now they've also signed import defensive backs Burt Brown and David James, along with an import linebacker, Daniel Sheffield. So those guys, you've got Brown is a 6 foot, 169 pound. Are you kidding me? 169, he's not very heavy at all, is he? Well, he played at Union College all 4 years. He racked up 123 tackles. So I guess his size hasn't been an impediment. And James is 5'11", 190 pounds. Sheffield, 6'3", 206 pounds. So these are all young players. They're Americans, and they're good additions to the Winnipeg team. Winnipeg has a new stadium. That is really the cornerstone of their sales pitch this year, whether they admit it or not. That is what's going to sell in Winnipeg, is the new stadium. And for those of us that live in cities where new stadiums were created, we all know, you know, the thrill of going to the stadium almost over, yeah, it does. It actually oversells the team sometimes. So Winnipeg, hopefully they'll put a decent team out there as well. It looks like they will. They're being a little conservative, I have to say. But that conservatism isn't a bad thing. There are a lot of teams making a lot of moves that are really important. So the news out of Ticatville, single game tickets are available now for any ticket that you want to buy, a single ticket for any of the Ticat games. They are available now. Now, the Ticats have drafted 8 players. One of them, well, hang on a second, that was in Ottawa. Simon Lamarcant, we interviewed him here. He's from Gatineau, Quebec. He was signed in the 35th selection in the 4th round. I hope he does well. He's a good kid, and I enjoyed our interview. And he really is a big Quebec receiver. And he's the kind of guy that I think will fit in well with Hamilton. Historically, big receivers have done a lot of good in Hamilton. And Kent Austin, as an experienced CFL man, knows full well that size coming out of the backfield for short yardage is a good asset to have. And Simon Lamarcant looks like he'll fit that mold. Now, will he be an important player this year, or will they work on his skills and he be more prolific next year? I'm going to go on a limb here, folks, and I'm going to tell you the Gatineau Quebec native is going to make an impact immediately on the field. Ticats also took from McMaster defensive back Mike Daly, 45th overall, and in the 6th round, St. Mary's kicker Brent Lothar. Kicking is an important tool in the CFL, and hopefully, you know, they will get somebody that, you know, that will be useful to the team. Now, Hamilton is a team looking to rebound, and they basically got the best player available in the draft, which is what should happen with the team that drafts first. Lyndon Gaydosh, the Calgary Dinos, 314-pound, 6'3", tackle defensively, was a force with the Dinos, and he had incredible results at the combine. And I think it's going to be amazing. This kid's awesome, and Hamilton is very fortunate. This kid guarantees that they're going to have a Canadian in a position that will be able to compete with other players from the U.S. favorably. Again, I repeat, allowing an American to play in another position where they can dominate. It's the reality of the CFL. The ratio is an important deal, and Gaydosh really, really, really will help in that ratio that is so important in CFL football. Well, Austin promised that he'd keep his draft options open. He did. The other news, they opened the draft to seven rounds first time. So that'll be our Hamilton team. And in Montreal, they're the team that, I don't know, ooh, it's going to be interesting. Being a Montreal fan is going to be interesting this year. But I believe, and you can trust, that Jim Popp is going to have as competitive a team as there is in the East playing in Montreal. You can bet on that. So another guy that we interviewed, Nicolas Boulay, has ended up in Montreal. Boulay, another fine talent, and he has a great opportunity with a team that needs some guys on the defensive side and the backfield as a linebacker. This kid's quick, and he's hungry. goes after players. And if you've seen any of the game film with this kid, God, he's just a seek and destroy guy. He just goes after people, and he gets his wish. He gets the player. So, yeah, this is an aggressive football player. Nicholas, congratulations on landing in Montreal. We should call these guys back that we interviewed and ask them how it's going. Now they've been drafted, and call them and see what they have to say. I asked them if I could call them after they got drafted, and they all said, yeah, yeah, I won't forget who you are. Should we do it live just to see that if they're telling the truth? What do you think? I think they're telling the truth. I think they'll answer the phone. They may not talk to me, but they'll answer the phone. I'm not going to call them now. Oh, jeez. The Outlets also invited their fans to give blood. I can't tell you how that turned out, but it was nice of them to ask that. Another soft landing, and I call it a soft landing because predictability about it wasn't 100%. Simon Lagarde, he landed in Montreal, and which is a good thing for Montreal. Again, they get another surprise player that will help the team. You don't expect in the CFL players that are local to say no to you. Let's keep that in mind. It's just that you're not sure when they're going to be freed up so that they can come to play for your team. So this is one of the things that, that the CFL has turned into, and they really have, and I think it's a positive thing, where they're bringing in local guys to play for their local teams. I mean, it is kind of like moving the deck chairs around, but still, you know, it's moving the deck chairs appropriately near the people that appreciate the type of deck chair you're talking about, making the deck chair more useful, more beneficial. So, yeah, local players who aren't high impact, that doesn't mean they're not impact, but high impact players that stay out of town, in other words, play for other teams in other cities because they're high impact. But the ones that are impact players, medium impact, them moving around is a good thing. If they end up home, you know, can we be real here? Can we talk real? It's a good thing in the CFL because some of these guys, believe it or not, aren't making a ton of cash. And if they can stay home and pursue their love of the game of football, something we established here on this program over and over and over again for weeks during the spring and the late winter, where a lot of young players, they just love playing the game. That's why they're here. It's not about money. So if you can say you can play near home, live at home, and still play and not have to uproot yourself, I think that's cool. I think that's great. And again, probably another reason why CFL players love their community, because it actually is the community that they know and they grew up in. Now we'll move on to the team known as the Toronto Argonauts. It's been an interesting spring. It truly has. It has been an interesting spring. Let's start with the town hall. I don't know if I should check to see, because, you know, if he's messaging me and I'm not paying attention, he's going to get mad at me. Nope, John's not messaging me. So, oh, wait, somebody is. Hang on. Let's find him. Okay. So we'll leave it at that and go back to what we were talking about. How's that? We'll go back to what we were talking about. So we're talking about the Argos. Went to the town hall, and I was very impressed. It was my first town hall. I went there with the intention of having fun, and I succeeded in doing that. You could say I participated in the event. You could say I participated eagerly in the event. And most of all, you could say I had fun participating in the event. As a member of the Argo Lifers, we also support the boat logo. And this year, the 23rd of August, I think, Calgary against Calgary. Yeah, they'll be playing with their throwback jerseys. They're not really throwback jerseys. I think they invented a new jersey for it. It's a new boat logo jersey, which Dan Ferrone wore at the event. and I think as many as 15 players from that 83 team that won the Grey Cup wearing the boat logo jersey will be honored at the game, one of which is Dan Frohn, another is Jan Karinci, two guys that we interviewed on this show. And it'll be really interesting, mostly because 83 is a long time ago. When you think about it, 83 is 30 years ago, man. And 30 years ago, the Toronto Argonauts were, before the season started and during the season and prior to the Grey Cup of that year in BC, the first Dome Stadium Grey Cup, the Argos were the Argos, the team that couldn't win, the team that snatched defeat from the jaws of victory, much like the Leafs did tonight. The important thing to note is that they won that Grey Cup. And in winning that Grey Cup, they changed history. The Argos had gone for years without winning a Grey Cup. And in not winning the Grey Cup for so long, I think Argo fans became accustomed to them losing. And in 81, 2 years before they won the Grey Cup, probably had the worst team ever. And what we were talking about at the town hall is, where are we going to play? That's my biggest concern, really, to be honest with you, with discussions that the Blue Jays are planning on bringing in real turf, real grass. If they do so, and when they do so, they will not be able to have the Argos in the stadium, because football just tends to tear up the grass really badly. But it wouldn't really matter, because quite frankly, it's the Blue Jays stadium, and the Blue Jays, no matter how much damage is done to the grass, it'll still be too much. Let's take a short break. I'd like to discuss some more Argos, and the number here is 714-242-5250. 714-242-5250. If you want to call in.
The following is a message from the 2012 Grey Cup champions, your Toronto Argonauts. If you didn't hear your voice, there's still time to be a part of next year's crowd. It's okay to pile on. Get your 2013 season tickets today. Call 416-341-ARGO or go to argonauts.ca.
Argo!
Do you want to be heard, disagreed with, or just plain shot down? Come on! Be brave! Call the Candid Frank Live Show, a.k.a. the CFL Show. You already hit the link to bring up the player, and you hit the play button so you can hear us. Now hit that little Skype button on that Candid Live player sitting there, like your pet wanting a snack, so to connect with us and tell us your thoughts. Hit that little tiny, cute, and tempting Skype button, right? Now, do it! Or call 714-242-5250. That's 714-242-5250. That's correct. Those are the numbers that call. So the Argos have brought home Matt Sewell. You heard him on the show here. Great young player. And I think there's a lot of good news. Well, Mark Parenteau, if you go to the Argos webpage, does a great story on the town hall. Toronto Argonauts also signed import wide receiver John Chiles and import linebacker Major Culbert. Chiles spent time in the St. Louis Rams. He had a brief stint in the Jacksonville Sharks. He was also a member of the New Orleans Saints in 2011. And this Texas Longhorn honor roll player spent the majority of his college career as a receiver, but arrived as a freshman backup quarterback in his 4 years at Texas. Chiles caught 63 passes for 737 yards. Now, the NFL has provided some really good players for the for the Argos. Major Culbert spent 3 years in Nebraska. He then ended up at Abilene Christian back 3 years ago. While there, he had 3 interceptions, 2 punt returns for a total of 4 yards. Culbert was both a running back and a kick returner, so this kid's going to be a special teams guy. The Argonauts also announced that the club released non-import Kyle Jones and non-import Walter Spencer. Now, whenever Jim Barker does something like that, releases a player, he always says, don't be surprised if they come back. It's all about a numbers game, and that's obvious. Now, broadcaster Don Landry says there's good things to come, especially if you're patient. You know what? Let's check out what Mr. Landry's saying. You guys read what Landry's saying? He says that good things come to people who wait. Yeah, I can agree with that. Instant gratification isn't what it's all about. He's made some picks, that being Barker, in the 2013 draft. That, let's be honest, may not show any benefit this year. But the feeling is that in the next couple of years, these players are going to grow into replacing the players that the Argos lose for various reasons. But then again, we'll see how things turn out. One thing's for sure, the Argos are the defending champion. And as promised, a lot of the talk was about with Obilovich there, along with Dan Ferrone. Obilovich is quite a humor-filled man. Let me tell you, he was funny. He was really funny. He had a lot of funny things to say, and Dan Ferrone was a good sidekick for him. So, yeah, as I said, August 23rd at the Rogers Center, Ferrone displayed the jersey they'll be wearing. His name on the back is number 69, and above his name, the boat logo. Just a small little boat logo emblem. I assume the helmets will have the full boat logo on them. And Condridge Holloway will be there. Joe Barnes will be there. Carl Brazely. Three players that were very prominent in the 1983 victory. Brazely, of course, the defensive player who played in Ottawa, came to Toronto. Didn't look like a good fit, but man, did he play well at the right time. And, you know, you figure 30 years ago, the Argos won a Grey Cup after 31 years not winning one. Damn, that's a long time. That's 61 years. For someone to actually feel what we're talking about, I'm almost there. But I can't say that I remember all that clearly. But yeah, I'm good for about 20 to 25 of those losing years. I remember a couple of Grey Cups. Leon McQuay dropping the ball. Leo Cahill. Hey, man, we had some interesting teams who knew how to lose in style. I mean, when you lose all the time, you can lose in style. They did a great job. I'm really happy with the Argos last year. And if you have an opportunity to buy season tickets, it's something you won't regret. It's good football, good brand of football, very entertaining. And you will totally enjoy the game. You totally will. We'll take another break. And a little musical interlude. Let's see if he answers the phone. You think?
call him. We'll see if he answers the phone. Good. Is that the answering machine? Are you there? Are you there? Are you there? Somebody's picked up the phone. The phone's live and kicking. Oh, maybe not then.
Loved this sport as a kid. I loved it. We played it on a tennis court. Loved it.
You wanted to start the whole newscast with this.
Yeah. Well, roller hockey can be tough. It can be brutal at times. A lot of high sticking. That is not stopping some kids, well, girls, from taking the floor and showing off their skills.
They are kind of like kids, probably, when you compare ages here. They are showing off their bodies. You see, this is a bikini hockey league, and our hockey expert, and we mean that, Kristen Keough, yeah, met a local woman who says this sport is the next big thing. They might even draw bigger crowds than the Coyotes do occasionally.
They just might, and wait till you see their outfits, and you'll definitely be thinking that. But you said that kids, and then maybe comparatively they may seem like kids, but that's not true, actually, because the woman that we met from Scottsdale that plays in the Bikini Hockey League, she's 39 years old, and she is the oldest member of this league. There was even just a reality show shot about the BHL over the summer. Some of the women are 19 years old, but she is proud to be 39 and representing as a member of the Bikini Hockey League. Check it out.
Heather Josie Moore admits that when she first heard of bikini hockey, she had to laugh.
And I kind of thought it was a joke. It's like, okay.
But the 39-year-old quickly realized it could mean more time playing her favorite sport. So she auditioned for the new Bikini Hockey League.
I kind of worked the whole angle of, I think you guys need me because you need an old lady on the team. So that way, if it does go to, you know, syndication, they could market products like wrinkle cream and whatnot.
She landed a spot on the team and headed to Oklahoma for filming. The mom of one is naturally nurturing. Tonight, she even took the time to teach me how to play.
I'm going to play it real slow for you. Oh, see, that's good.
But Moore says those motherly instincts also make her a mean defender. You can see during filming, she took a shot to her bare belly to defend the net.
I don't know what came over me. I just rushed in front of that puck and flexed and stood there and took it. And luckily, it fell to my left side, and I'm a lefty. So everyone was so shocked and thought I was going to, like, I don't know, sit down and cry or something.
Moore believes that bikini tops and beauty will get viewers tuning in, but it's the true talent that will have them coming back for more.
They're going to see so much, and I think everyone's going to forget about the bikinis and just start noticing the camaraderie and the hockey community, which it's all about.
I don't know if anybody's going to forget about the bikinis, but Heather does tell me that since she started playing, she gets to eat whatever she wants because all that practice keeps her in such good shape. John, Carrie, I know you got to have a lot of questions.
I have a ton. First of all, I'm not kidding. This is not condescending. I was amazed at the skill.
Yes.
Stick handling, they were talented.
They are really good, and that was actually a point that Heather made. She said she's actually saying that she's the least talented person on the team. Her personality takes her very far, as you can tell, but she says everyone is going to be absolutely floored to see how well these girls actually go out and perform as athletes.
Yeah, John's not kidding. His first comment was on the skill level. His second comment, now that's something I'm not going to go into.
Well, we can't say that on TV.
I'm wondering where the season ticket package is. Can I buy this in advance?
You know what? You're going to be able to watch it in your living room at some point.
Oh, no.
So,
wow. I'm sure the whole family will gather around for that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, if your wife allows
you to. One of the things we said that we can repeat on TV is how, and I got to ask this as a woman, because I like to wear a bikini occasionally, How does everything stay put, if you know what I mean? They're moving around pretty fast. Do they use tape?
They have a company that provides their bikinis, and I have a feeling that that is something that is handled during fitting. There might be some
handled carefully.
Some safety pins.
A thousand
some
and
super
one
glue.
Uses for duct tape.
Yeah,
reversible
tape. Yeah. It really is amazing, though. She's 39 years old. She has an 11-year-old.
Wow.
And she says they actually started playing together. She started playing when he was 9, and it was one of those things where he would play the sport, and she would try to talk to him about it, and he would say, well, Mom, you got to play to get it. So she did.
I do have one more quick question because we're getting wrapped. Is the goalie a woman as well who looks good in a bikini?
Yes.
I noticed they were fully clothed.
They all look good in bikinis, but the goalie gets to be fully clothed. And even though she was, Heather still stepped in front of her with a bare belly.
Yep.
She's a good player. Tough
man.
Ladies.
Hello out there, we're on the air, it's hockey night tonight. Tension grows, the whistle blows, and the puck goes down the ice. The goalie jumps and the players bump and the fans all go insane. Someone roars, Bobby scores at the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Second period, where players dash with skates aflash, the home team trails behind, but they grab the puck and go bursting up, and they're down across the line. They storm the crease like bumblebees, they travel like a burning flame. We see them slide the puck inside, it's a 1-1 hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name, and the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Third period, last game in the playoffs, too. Oh, take me where the hockey players face off down the rink, and the Stanley Cup is all filled up for the champs who win the drink. Now the final flick of a hockey stick and a one gigantic scream. The puck is in, the home team wins the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game.
Yes, the good old hockey game. How else would you describe it other than being the good old hockey game? Well, we got one Canadian team left. Hopefully Ottawa will be able to carry that red and white flag. I guess they got to hope for somebody else to beat Boston because, Boston's strong and all. Let's see. Duty, 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 duty. You know what? I feel like, let's do this first. There we go.
Hello, fellow of your Toronto Argonauts, and you're listening to Candid Frank Live.
Thanks, buddy. That was really nice of you to say that. That was one take, by the way. You did it all in one take. You sure did. Let's go to an interview with Jan Crenshie.
Hello. So there was one Grey Cup victory with the Argonauts, 1983, 30th year anniversary coming up this year. Selfless plug, there will be a celebration of the Calgary game August 23rd, and probably all of your old-time favorites from the 83 team, Connor Holloway, Carl Brazley, Terry Greer, Dan Ferrone, and even me making the trip from Mauritius, which, as you said, southwestern Indian Ocean, 8,000 miles from Moncton, which is the last place I live in Canada, all the way back to Toronto.
And I remember a story you told me about taking out the golf clubs for the first time in Mauritius. Tell the folks about that.
That was hilarious. I've got an iPhone, and on the iPhone I've got a GPS golf app that tells me how far far it is away I am from, you know, whatever hole I happen to be on, at whatever golf course I'm playing. And I had always had it set up to be on the golf course that I was playing in New Brunswick in Moncton, which was Royal Oaks. And I guess I hadn't turned it off the last time I used it, because when I turned it on here, it immediately took me to the Royal Oaks map. And it said, you are 8,332 miles away from the pin on the seventh hole at Royal Oaks. Now, what would have been fun is when it said at the bottom, we suggest you use driver. But you kind of get the gist of the story.
Now, that is funny. And you did mention that you lived in Moncton, New Brunswick. You've been a person who's traveled. I mentioned earlier that you were born in London, England. You came to Toronto, right? Your family came to Toronto, and that's where you picked up the football bug?
Yeah, we came to Toronto when I was six, okay? And it wasn't the football bug that I picked up, rather the hockey bug, because this was 1966. And those of you old enough as you and I are, Frank, will remember that in 1966-67, what happened?
The Leafs won the Cup.
Exactly. So I became a huge Leaf fan, you know, back in the glory days of the original six, and just was all set to you know, later, you know, after that summer, to play hockey at the age of nine. And right, I think it was the middle of August or maybe beginning of September, my neighbor up the street, Larry Aiken, came to me and he said, listen, we play football. Do you want to play football? And I went, oh, that sounds like fun. Okay, sure. And he was a real football fan and instrumental in making me a football player rather than a hockey player. Now, I couldn't skate to save my life anyway, so that probably wasn't going to happen. But we played in the Scarborough Boys Football League in the East End of Toronto, and it was a weight league team, 90 pounds and under, and I played on the Scarborough Mustangs, age nine, and I was an offensive center. And all I knew that I was supposed to do was just give the ball to the quarterback, and I probably would just fall down and you know, try to get in someone's way that was trying to tackle the guy that had the ball for our team. But I had no idea what I was doing. The only thing that I remember was that at the time, there was a guy playing in the CFL who wore number 44, the same number that I had. His name was Basil Bark.
B-squared.
So good old Basil Bark was my hero for all of 1 year. And then over the following winter and spring, I grew about 3 or 4 inches, and it seemed like everybody else didn't. And that following year, I still played for the Scarborough Boys Football League, the Scarborough Mustangs, and I was a running back, and I wore number 14, and that's when I started really paying attention to the CFL, because number 14 for the Toronto Argonauts was Dave.
Keon.
Come on. Nope. I've tested you here.
Number 14, what year?
Toronto Argonauts. Played both ways.
Oh, not Toronto that. Argonauts.
And
was it
Winnipeg?
No.
Do you need to call a lifeline?
You got me.
Okay, I got you. Dave Ramey.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, great football player, two-way player, which, you know, unbeknownst to me, I would go on to play two ways. Some would say greatly, some would not. But yeah, that's when I got hooked. And after that, it was I couldn't get enough football. Ended up switching teams and going and playing for the East Gilwood Argonauts, coached by a guy by the name of Bill Jukes. And I don't know if anybody in Toronto is listening right now, but Bill Jukes coached me from the time I was 11 till the time I was 17, went to Maryland. And on his coaching staff was a man by the name of John Case. And Mr. Case, as we would call him, was our equipment manager and also our offensive line coach. John Case died yesterday after a battle with cancer that they found out about in December. So any fans in Toronto that Scarborough especially that remember John, great man, great role model for us kids back then, in who taught us you know, the real meaning of responsibility and of volunteerism especially. for a guy that would be there at every practice, every game, just encouraging us to play as well as we could, be as good as we could. So we just want to acknowledge that, if I could. Thanks.
Well, you know, there is football in Canada would not exist without volunteers.
Well, for me, it was more than high school football. It was the Scarborough Boys Football League, and again, back to your point on the volunteers and the coaches and you know, their wives that would wash the uniforms and cut oranges at halftime and all of this stuff. And I would play Scarborough Boys Football League. We would practice two or three times a week. We would play our games on the weekend. And I would do that after practicing every day of the week and playing games with our high school team. The bug is one way of saying it. I like to call it a passion. If you can get a kid involved in a passion as early as possible, that kid will grow up the right way and adopt the things that you want your child to be. A kid who has a passion about something is an amazing thing. They're driven. They just want it. It's all consumed by this thing, whatever it is, whether it's the piano, whether it's football, whether it's whatever it is. And it's really neat to see. I'm watching my daughter right now kind of get that bug with swimming. We just got back from her hour in the pool today, and she said to me, "Daddy, you know what? The front crawl, I'm nailing it. I'm starting to get it. It's happening for me." And when you hear that excitement in her voice, that's kind of cool. Yeah, there's got to be balance. There's got to be all this other stuff, especially the academics. But we would practice, and in high school especially, we were good. We had some good football players on the teams that we had. Mike Kirkley was a first round draft choice, a running back that was on the same team that I was on. Bill Mitsoulas was a wide receiver that played on the same team. You know, Rob Owen, a guy that tragically, gosh, this is two deaths on the same show, Frank, who tragically died, in grade 13, was a great football player, probably would have made it to the CFL. We were good, and at the same time, we knew it. We played in the what would now be considered the Metro Bowl against Wexford. Wexford was like 32-0. They were unbelievable. We beat them 32-12. Wow. In the championship game, we just crushed it, just absolutely steamrolled, and that's how good we were. On the other side of it, the team that Bill Jukes, who was my coach, again from the time I was 11 till I went to Maryland, we formed a team after we came out of the Scarborough Boys Football League called the Scarborough Vikings. Scarborough Vikings won four consecutive Ontario championships. And play a team, they would have these two. The last one that I remember was in Hamilton. The big games were played at Iverwind Stadium. And a team came up from Cincinnati called the Cincinnati Tomahawks. And they looked just like the Cincinnati Bengals. They had warm-up jackets. They had all of this equipment. I mean, there must have been like 60 of them on the sideline. And we kicked off to them. Now, like, this is an American, serious football team. We kicked off to them. They took the ball back, I don't know, 60, 70 yards. I miss a tackle. They're up 7-0. The game's 15 seconds old. We beat them 67-7. Okay? We just trashed them.
Sounds like your 81 year with the Argos.
Well, in reverse. But we were good. And it was, and Jukes was the type of coaches would say, don't ever get out hit. And teams would fold on us in the third quarter because we would just out-punish them. The famous Vince Lombardi sweep, we're going to keep running it and running it and running it until that corner and that halfback and that defensive end are so pounded that they're just going to lay down. And that's football. That's why there's so much football terminology in World War I and World War II. End sweep, blitz, all of it. It's war out there, and the strongest survive. And that's how I was taught how to play. I don't know that I could play right now, in this era of, A, protect the quarterback. B, you're not allowed to lower your head. C, don't hit with the crown of your helmet. D, you know, why don't we just go back to two-hand touch and see if that works, see if that'll sell tickets. I can guarantee you one thing.
What was different when you went to Maryland?
Oh, before I even got on the field, what was different was two-a-day practice every day. Two-a-day, every day, 2 hours in the sweltering heat, which is Maryland, and just in case folks don't know exactly where we are just outside of the Beltway of Washington, D.C. Okay, it's hot, it's humid, it's two-a-days. There's 95 scholarship athletes down there running around on 3 football fields, plus all the guys that are silly enough to try to walk on, guys that don't have scholarships but think they can make the team, of which usually you'll get one or two guys, and there's been some great stories of great walk-ons, so I don't mean to bag on walk-on. But the regimen of this whole thing was something that I wasn't used to, and to be honest with you, something I didn't like. And as a freshman down there, looking at this whole situation, going, yeah, do I really want to do this for 4 years? When this is August of 1977 now. When in May of 1977, the Toronto Argonauts had offered me a contract, and I'm thinking to myself, do I really want to do this? And forego, you know, the next 3 years waiting for you know, a chance to land with the Argonauts? And my decision was quite easily made. I said, no, I don't want to do this. And I continued to participate as far as the football side of things were concerned. I made the travel roster. I hardly ever played. There were two seniors and a junior ahead of me. Those were the guys that were playing, and then there was also two sophomores. So I'm looking at this going, unless I do something really spectacular in the springtime, I'm probably going to sit on the bench next year too. And I'm like, okay, I'm not doing this. I'm packing it in. After the football season's done, I'm going to go back to Toronto, and I'm going to contact the Argonauts, and I'm going to see if they still want me to play, and you know, see how that goes. I get back to Toronto in December, and I call Jim Copeland, and I tell him this is the same story I just said. And he's the director of Canadian player
development.
Canadian player development, yeah. And he says to me, did you step on the field for Maryland? I said, yeah, of course I did. I did play a little bit. And he said, well, you are now actually ineligible to play in the CFL as a Canadian until your class graduates in 1981. I didn't know that. And to be quite honest with you, Frank, I don't know if that's a true statement or not, or whether Jim was just trying to take care of my best interests. In other words, stay at Maryland, get your education, you will play. And I don't know whether or not it was the truth or whether or not he was looking after my best interest. Long story short, I go back to Maryland. I go to summer school and you're talking, I was a 4-year honor student at Agent Court, okay? You're talking about a guy who has to go to 2 semesters of summer school just to remain eligible for a scholarship, because the first semester I was down there, once I realized I wasn't staying, I didn't go to class.
Oh, no.
Okay? Oh, absolutely. Oh, no, no. I was down there playing football and having a good time.
Now, it wasn't just your decision to stay there. From what I understand, your family also, the same way Copeland did, gave you sound advice and support.
Yeah, that was in training camp, and there was, that definitely happened. I was lonely. I hadn't really been away from home. You know, 17 years old, I hadn't been away from home for an extended period of time at all, and my parents were very supportive, and I had 2 very, very young brothers at the time. I think Tino was 6 and Marco was 4, and you know, they came down and I would play with the kids all the time. We were always rough and tumble whenever I was around with them, and there was great support from them. But that was at the beginning of the season. My thought process hadn't changed by the end of the season. Patience. It was a lot of hard work. I had to. Not only did I have to get my grades back, I had to. I You know, I had to get in the gym. I had to hit the weights. I had to do everything because it seemed through winter workouts. This is a funny story. I come back after the first after the second semester. So we're talking spring of 1978 now. And my dad looks at me and says, "What's going on?" I'm like, "What do you mean?" He said, "Well, when in high school, you played football, basketball, and you ran track and field. And, like, what are you doing at Maryland? All you're doing is playing football." I said, "Wait a sec, Dad. You know what? They give me a football scholarship. They give other guys basketball scholarships, and they give other guys track and field scholarships. Okay? And in football at Maryland, you play this. You go to training camp 2 days. Then you play the season. Then they give you if you're lucky enough to go to a bowl game, you have to practice 3 weeks for that, which we did my freshman year. Then you come back, and it's now, you know, it's winter, it's the off season. Then you do indoor training for 5 weeks, and then by the time that's done, you have March break, and then you do spring football. When do you find time for me to play basketball and run track and field?" So he got educated on that side of things. But about midway through winter workouts, still in my freshman year, going into my sophomore year, I started to look around and I started to see myself performing better than the upperclassmen that were ahead of me. And I knew that in spring ball, if I could take what I was doing in the workout sessions and put it on the field, that I probably had a really good chance to start. And that's motivation. And the grades were coming together. I was right back studying and doing all of the things that a student athlete is supposed to do. And I started to get pretty excited about the next 3 years that were ahead of me. And sure enough, I ended up winning the starting job in spring football my freshman year. And then, stayed down there the entire summer working on the grades. And by the time the next fall practice came along, I was already penciled in. See, we've got to kind of just take a quick step back. I came second in receiving in my sophomore year with 21 receptions, and this is a football team. The University of Maryland, my dad would have a saying, you know, they run the ball left, they run the ball right, and to make things different, they run the ball up the middle. We didn't pass unless it was 3rd and 19. And usually when we did that, it was coming to me. So to finish leading the team as a junior in receptions with 30 catches, that was quite a bit back then. Now kids are. I look at G. Roy Simon, his senior year at Maryland. You've heard that name, I think. Yes. His senior year at Maryland, I think he caught 80 passes. And didn't lead the ACC in receptions. Yeah. So I was like 3rd in the league in receptions with 30 catches back in 1979. So, you know, it was progressing, things were going well, and then, you know, 2 days before training camp my senior year, I'm in there lifting weights with linebackers for some really stupid reason. I give my hand a shake every time I think about it. And I'm trying to put up too much weight. I'm trying to bench 275, which back then was respectable. Now it's nothing. And my right leg slipped, my left leg took all the weight, and I tore a cartilage, the meniscus on my knee, and it's got big as a basketball, and I had to have surgery to replace it the day training camp started, my senior year. There I am, preseason all ACC, coming off of an all ACC academic, Dean's List, junior year, all of the hype, all of the this, all of the that, and it just got trashed with that one silly little bench press accident. So now you finish the season. I finished the season with 9 catches. We go to the Tangerine Bowl. Me and Chris Collinsworth have a little bit of a duel. You remember that name? He catches a few more balls than I do. Florida beats us in the Tangerine Bowl, and now it's time to look at, you know, what's next. The Argonauts back in the day had two territorial protectorates. That ended, I think, in 1984-85. And what a territorial protectorate was a you had the right to protect a player that grew up in your area of influence. Yeah, exactly. And at the same time, there was no combine, CFL or NFL. But what NFL scouts would do, they would come to your school and they would, check out players. They would create a list for your coaches to come up with the players and provide them with. Well, one of the guys that was fairly there were several guys that we had that were fairly heavily recruited. Eric Stevers, who played for the San Diego Chargers for 10 years, Lloyd Burris with the Kansas City Chiefs for 11, Mike Tice, still active in the NFL as a coach for Chicago, was a tight end for Seattle and Minnesota, John Tyson's brother, same thing. So when you've got a defensive back that they want to take a look at, they being the NFL, in your backyard, in your practice facility, well, you need a receiver to run routes against them, right?
Yeah.
And you need a quarterback to throw the ball. So Lloyd Burris, Mike Tice, who would go on to be NFL, 10, 11, 12-year guys, and me, catching Tice's balls, running routes against Lloyd. Well, I ran routes against Lloyd for the last 4 years. I knew what I could do, and I knew what I couldn't do. So now, all of a sudden, I'm catching balls against this guy who's projected to be a second- or third-round draft choice, and they're coming up to me going, what are your plans? Anyway, the long and the short of it was they were Philadelphia, the Giants, and Minnesota were talking free agent contract, but each one of them, and this wasn't done in a group. Each one of them individually said, "But you'd be crazy not to go back to Toronto. They've got two protectorates that they can just pick you right off the pot. You're not going to even be in the draft." And at the time, the CFL was paying comparably, almost on par with a sixth, seventh round draft choice in the NFL. The NFL wasn't, you remember back in the 80s, guys were getting, first round draft choices were getting plucked. Bruce Clark in 1980 out of Penn State was a first round draft choice, played with Toronto Argonauts. Was a linebacker with Montreal. There were several players that were high draft choices. The CFL was paying a lot of money in the 80s. And guys were going north, and they said to me, you'd be crazy. So, the offensive coordinator for the Argonauts visited the school roughly about the same time. So you're talking about this is April, May of 1981. And his name was Steve Goldman. And he arranged to come in and sit down and have dinner with the team and talk to me while I was having dinner. So you've got 95 guys sitting around, big tables of 10. And there's me and Steve sitting all by ourselves at one of these other tables, and we're eating, and he's got all of his Argonaut gear on, and guys are, looking and going, what the heck is going on? Because you got to remember, training camp starts in a month, right? In the NFL, training camp wasn't starting until August. So he looks at me, and he goes, so listen, if we protect you, will you come to Toronto and play for the Argonauts? And he was quite serious. They didn't know. And I was just sitting there waiting for the invitation. sitting there going, of course I'm coming. I didn't say that. But are you crazy? Of course I'm coming. Yes, I think that would be a good career move for me.
And it really was.
I couldn't hardly compose myself. You're talking about a 22-year-old kid who had watched McQuay fumble, cried my eyes out during that one, okay? Watched every Argo game from the time I was, 11 on, and now I get to come back and play? For Canucks? Oh, yeah, I think this is good. This is what I want.
Can I add something in there? Also, it was the heyday of the Toronto Argonauts. They were drawing, I think, around 40,000 people, anywhere between 30, 40, and sometimes, they filled Exhibition Stadium.
Yeah, all the good seats.
Yes.
Certainly all the good seats. I mean, what they did to Exhibition Stadium to accommodate the Blue Jays was ridiculous, but certainly all the good seats, and yeah, it was a heyday. It was like the Leafs. They were selling out, but they weren't winning.
Right.
You know, just goofy and spending a lot of money.
Absolutely.
You know? So
and bring
yeah.
in some serious talent up north.
I was. Yeah, but their serious talent was always focused on Americans. Yeah,
absolutely.
And you've got to have quality Americans playing. There's no doubt about that. Especially your quarterbacks, obviously. And some of your other skill position guys. We're starting to see. When I played in the CFL, it was very easy to tell who the Canadians were and who the Americans were. Now it's getting, with the way Canada has the culture in Canada has changed. It's very difficult. I mean, we're seeing kids that I can remember having to translate. Between an American defensive back and a Canadian defensive back who was very, very Jamaican, and they couldn't understand each other. Okay, and it's a bit of a joke, but it's also reality. Now, there's no confusion at all. You don't know who's who. You don't know who's Canadian, who's American, until you read it in the program. And it's amazing. It says a lot for the development of the Canadian player in the last 25 years. It really does.
Jan, I think, at some point, I won't define it, but at some point it became clear to all the CFL teams, obviously from one to the next and to all of them, that your Canadian content, as it did this year for the Toronto Argonauts, can win you a championship.
Yeah, and I think if you're looking for a date on the CFL calendar that probably best exemplifies that is the 5 years that the Edmonton Eskimos won Grey Cup. Yeah, I mean their Canadian talent was unbelievable. When was the last time you saw a fullback like Neil Lumsden? Are you kidding me? I don't think there's been one since. And he's just one example of a bunch of guys, Marco Sinkar, the guys that they had offensive line. It didn't matter. Every position, they had quality Canadians. And I think that, to Bob Obilovich's credit, is what he did, is what he focused on in 19, as he was coming into 1982 as the head coach. And of course, Ralph Stasio.
Hang on, you're getting ahead of me here. You're getting ahead of me. Let's just
take a step back. Oh, you want to talk about 81?
Well, we do. It was your rookie year, and I've seen it quoted that even though you played all 16 games, it could be defined as a nightmare year for you. What made it such a nightmare?
I don't know if we have time.
Oh, no.
Okay, lose the first 11 straight. That's the first one. We end up 2-14. We still had a chance to make the playoffs if we win the last game. I try to catch a pass. I don't even know if it was Connors who threw. I don't think it was because Connors would have hit me in the numbers. But if I catch this ball between my knees, which is where it was thrown, and roll into the end zone, we beat Hamilton the last game of the year and still make the playoffs. I'm in the middle of going through a bunch of pictures for Paul Woods. I know you're familiar with his project, Bouncing Back, the story of the book that's being written on the 83 Argo team. And I saw a press clipping that my mother, bless her soul, my mother had saved for me. And it's a picture of me throwing a cup of cold water on my face. And the tagline reads, "Oops, missed again." And the little cut line underneath says, "Sure, we could say that rookie Argonaut receiver Jan Karinci, had trouble finding his mouth. That would probably be appropriate given the fact that the Argos are having such a miserable season. But you know what? We won't say that. We'll just say that he was just trying to cool off on a hot day in Lamport Stadium as we were practicing. But that's what we were getting. The ultimate insult was the Toronto Blue Jays at the time not allowing us to cut into, and those who remember the X, remember that at the end of the left field line, there was an opening, and that opening was where they would bring in the, the big equipment for the concerts. They would that was where your big stuff would come in. All the Argonauts of that miserable 1981 year wanted to do as we left practice at the grass field while the Blue Jays were just getting ready to start a game were to walk in that entrance, walk underneath the catacombs of the stadium to our locker rooms, which meant that we would not have to walk through the 40,000 people that were getting ready to go to the Blue Jay game that just did nothing but taunt us. And in the summertime, you know how many baseball games are played. This would happen 2-3 times a week.
Yep.
We would just get just ridiculed, like just every single slur you could possibly imagine delivered that year. It was a horrible, horrible, horrible year. And there are a few fun memories, but not very many. And I don't know if it made us stronger. I guess it did, because the core guys were back in '82, and we can go on and discuss.
Did you have a sense that in '81, through the terrible experience, that there were some building blocks there, young building blocks in management and in the players, that you knew you could turn this thing around?
There definitely was no building blocks in management. Okay, they fired all of them. There were certain firings that were really, you know, you look back now and professional sports is a cruel game. Okay, you are only as good as what you've done for me lately, and you know, unfortunately, a great guy like Willie Wood, you know, we lose, I think, our first four games in 1981 by a total of 7 points, and you know, you can correct me on that one while I'm you know, yapping here, but you know, Willie was a great guy, but he was just a victim of wins and losses. And then they brought in some people that, you know, you constantly hear in the CFL about guys coming in with CFL experience as head coaches. Mm-hmm. And the guys that they brought in were all Americans. They, you know, very few of them had CFL experience. And I got to tell you one quick story, and then we'll start talking about the players. But we were getting ready to play somebody, I can't remember who it was, and we had lost. We were probably like 0-6 or 7 or 8 or 9 or whatever. And this assistant coach, he was charged with giving the pregame speech, and it was a great speech. He went on and on about, you know, the tough get going and the going get tough and the this and the that and every cliche you ever heard. And it was actually working. I looked around the room and I could see guys were, you know, the back was starting to straighten and the chin was coming out. Everything was like, you know, coming together. And he ended it with the following: "Now, get out there like good, young, red-blooded Americans and kick some ass."
And you did. Oh. No.
And all the Canadians looked around and went,
Here we go. There it is. Great coach. But Willie Wood, you mentioned, and you seem to have a real soft spot for him. This is a guy who won Super Bowl I with the Green Bay Packers. This is a guy who had all kinds of respect for his football mind. And if it wasn't for the color of his skin, he may not have needed to come to the Argos. He could have coached in the NFL. And like you said, I think he just caught a bad break, and he didn't get a chance to learn the Canadian game. And he was jettisoned. And the good news is Ralph Sazio came in. Now you have Bob Obilovich, who comes from Ottawa as an assistant coach. And you have a guy who understands the Canadian game and the fact that Canadians play it. Can you pick it up from there?
Yeah, just to finish on Willie, and you know, I think he was a victim of ownership and a GM that was you know, too active in telling him what it was that he wanted him to do. And that was very unfortunate, because Willie was a great guy. You know, he'd be out there. I made my money that year returning punts and playing on special teams, but he'd be out there at the beginning of practice trying to return punts. And this is a man who was in the National Football League Hall of Fame, obviously, as you said, won the first Super Bowl and played for Vince Lombardi. So you learn a few things, especially if you're going to become a coach, when you played for a guy like Vince Lombardi. And he'd be out there just, you know, he'd be out there 45, 50 pounds heavier than his playing days trying to return punts. And they, you know, you cradle a punt when you're catching it. And, well, Willie's stomach was getting in the way. So the ball would bounce off, and he'd laugh. And then we decided that we would get a little tricky here. And when you're a punt returner and you know what you're doing, you're capable of catching a ball behind your back. And this is a punt that is, you know, got a four or five second hang time. If you time it out properly, you can do it. Well, Willie saw me and Dave Newman doing this, and he decided he'd never seen this done before. So he thought this was just the greatest thing to try. I'm not kidding yet. We delayed practice a half hour one day until Willie finally did it. He's out there, and he's getting hit in the head with the ball. He's bouncing off his shoulders. It's hitting his butt. Everything. Now the entire team's out there waiting, right? Just waiting for him to finally do this. And sure enough, he got one. Okay, come on, man. Let's start practice now. It was just great. But no, you've got to have a guy that's got a little bit of control, and the biggest thing that we thought when Ralph Stasio came into the organization that he would want to control OB. But to his credit, Ralph gave OB a lot of freedom because OB had played in the as did Ralph, played in the league and coached and assistant coach anyway, and knew the game, knew what to do. You asked me about, you know, before we got all tangled up with management, you asked me about players and whether or not there was a light at the end of the tunnel. And yeah, definitely, no question about it. You talk about Connie Holloway to start, okay? And Connie's a guy that was not only a great athlete, but was a great leader, and a great leader, as far as I'm concerned, is someone who can get the most out of each and every individual teammate. Whether you know you're talking about a football team or whether or not you're talking about a corporation, and I think that Connie would be gifted if someone would ever take him and say, okay, you're going to be the CEO of my company. I think he'd do very well. He had a way of relating with everybody, from the guy who was, you know, out in the bars for the first 3 or 4 days of practice, if not seven, to the guy who was, you know, a born-again Christian, and everything in between. So there's your leader. There's where it starts. And then trickle down from there, and you've got a guy like Cedric Miller. You've got a guy like Paul Pearson, who, you know, just a great slot back, one of the best slots that the league's ever had. Terry Greer, Dan Ferroni, okay, Roland Mangold, Tom Trefo, John Malinowski on the offensive line. Great football players, all of them. And then you throw in a couple of defensive players, Carl Brazley, Lamont Meacham on the defensive line, Franklin King, character players, okay, that were already in the organization that Frank, well, sorry, Carl wasn't. Carl we got through trades. And that's the other piece of it, the trades that they made in 82. Carl Brazley, Rick Moore, Don Moen, you've probably done the research, there's a few more, but guys on defense that they brought in that really, really, James Curry, that trade, you know, Curry, huge game eventually down the road. You know, and then one guy that often gets forgotten, Darryl Mouse Davis, the author of the run and shoot offense. I mean, this guy's just a genius offensively. Just a genius.
He was also at that time known as the West Coast offense, because it was something.
Was it at that time, or did they hang the hat on the San Francisco 49ers West Coast offense after 1982?
I think after. I think you're right, after.
It was. I think it was, because we were the run and shoot. And Darryl had used the run and shoot at the University of Hawaii with June Jones, if you remember that name.
Yep, yep.
With June Jones as his quarterback. June is now using a version of it, I believe, with Atlanta. present day. I mean, someone will email us and tell us we're wrong on that one, but I think June Jones is with Atlanta and still using a version of Mouse's offense. But that offense, you couldn't touch it. You could not stop it because everything it had a variation. If you did this, we did that. If you did this plus that, we did this plus that. And you could, once we all got on the same page, so you're talking, at the time, Terry Greer, Jeff Townsend, Paul Pearson, Cedric Minner, and myself filling in for all of those guys. Dave Newman was back there. We all had to know all of the routes that all of the receivers and at that time you're talking five receiver sets, because the fullback at the time was a glorified offensive lineman who would turn around every once in a while catch a screen pass. But the five guys all had to know what each other was doing and most importantly where they were doing it on the field. And that was critical. And it took us, I think, the first four or five games to get it down. I remember a headline, run and shoot, misfires again. And, everybody was sitting there going, oh, here we go, same old Argos. And then once we got it, professional sports, just like going from high school to college, it's a very thin line. You have to step over it. College sports to professional sports, it's a very thin line to step over that. Being really good at the professional level is another very thin line. Once you figure out how to step over it, you got it. You've got it. And that's what that 82 team did. It took three or four or five games. Our defense kept us in a few of them because defense is just go crazy and hit people. But offensively, it took us a while to get his offense down. And then once we did, look out.
And it was very Moon. You must be really proud of the fact that how people underestimate and don't appreciate how good the Canadian game is and how good that Argo team was. And people may not remember, there was some talk at that time that the Argos, or did they play exhibition games against